Welcome to the Interactive Journey. Come along with us as we share the stories of parents, children, and professionals navigating a challenging world of various diagnoses, life transitions, and being human.
Thanks for tuning in to the Interactive Journey.
On today's episode, we talked to Sasha Long, a BCBA, former special education teacher, blogger,
international speaker, and creator of thousands of special education materials that you need to check out. Absolutely.
Founder and president of the Autism Helper. Come along with us as we explore Sasha's journey into the special education field, to the Autism Helper, and so much more. Let's go talk to her now.
Hi, Sasha. We're really excited to have you. For those who are listening, we have Sasha Long today with us. She is you're a blogger, you're a podcaster, you're a special educator, BCBA, really jack of all trades.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I try, apparently.
And we're here to talk to you about your journey that you're on right now with the Autism Helper and the resources that you're able to provide. So thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
We're really excited to have you, Sasha. I feel like I'm meeting a famous person because I've watched so many of your videos. Definitely. And listened to you so many times in the car. When we started on our journey, you were the first podcast that we actually listened to. I Googled ABA podcast and yours was on a website of like the top five.
Oh, great. It was my husband for a long time was like, because I think I'm on episode 180 of our podcast. So it's been maybe 3 years, maybe a little longer. But he went for a little bit before that, like a year before, he's like, you should start a podcast. And I didn't even listen to podcasts. I was like, do you pay for those? Like, are they on Netflix? Like, I don't understand. And then I started working. I was like, oh, I love this. Like, I can just chat. I don't have to put makeup on. I can like interview people. This is great. So it's been fun.
We're taking a poll though. Does your husband listen to your podcast?
Oh. No, he does not.
Yes.
No.
We get that a lot.
All right.
No.
But spouses are not a fan of listening.
No. He used to help me like record them, like sit with me and like whatever. And we have someone else that produces them. And after a little bit, he was like, you've got this. You're fine. I'm not going to. So no, he does not listen to them.
My husband, on the other hand, he listens to every single one and he takes notes and then he gives us feedback.
Oh.
So he's totally bought in. I don't know how long that'll last though.
Yeah. I love that.
Yeah, number one fan status.
Yeah.
Andrew. Yeah.
Kowalski, absolutely.
Hi. Yeah, get, get those downloads up. Come on. Yeah, it's good. Yeah. Listens.
I love it.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get to this point? Where did you come from? How'd you get to be where you are now?
So I started out as a special ed teacher. As an undergrad, which feels like a really long time ago, I originally wanted to be a social worker, but ironically, I was like, oh, I heard you have to get a master's to be a social worker, so I'm not going to do that. Because I was like, 18, and that seemed like more school than I wanted to do. Yeah. I ended up getting my master's anyways. But so I was like, all right, special ed's pretty similar to social work, which it's not, but I'll do that. So I kind of fell into special ed and I was lucky where I got my first job. It had other self-contained classrooms in the same building, which can sometimes, not happen. And my principal at the time was a young principal and he gave me a lot of freedom, which probably for some people sounds terrifying, but for me, it gave me the chance to figure out what to do and to trial and error things and get to know my learners and research and figure things out on my own and not be micromanaged, which I really enjoyed and I think flourished under. So I started as a special ed teacher. I became a BCBA while I was in the classroom, which was great. I would not have the energy for that now, but back in the day I did. I went to school at night, and what was awesome about that was, going to school at night and then coming back to my class the next day and being like, ooh, let's see that in action, or like, let's see how that works. And I always came to the field of ABA from a school background. Like, and I was always like the what if person in class. Like, well, what if you didn't have any staff? And what if you didn't have any resources? And what if the kid that was supposed to be there was there? And like, because in public schools, it's under-resourced, overcrowded. There's no, logistics rule the world on, yes, it'd be great to have an aide there, but we don't. So
yeah, that's the reality, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's the reality. So I always came to ABA from that perspective from day one, did my supervision in the classroom, did my thesis in the classroom. And once I was done with grad school, I was like, well, I'm used to working two full-time jobs, basically, so I should start a blog. And that was like pre-Instagram. Pinterest had just started and blogs were a thing. So I started a blog really to share what I was doing in my class, because I was always hungry for ideas. And like I said, when I was a young teacher, there was no, you know, Pinterest or teacher blogs or teacher Instagrams, all that. I had like those three task galore books. I don't know if you remember them. Mm-hmm. They're like, yes, the photos. Oh my God. Yeah. I made every single task in there because that was all I had. And so I wanted to just share what I was doing. So I started a blog sharing what I was doing, and I started selling my resources on Teachers Pay Teachers. And then from there, it really just snowballed. I started doing consulting on the side. I started doing speaking and professional development, and eventually, you know, left the classroom to do the Autism Helper full time. Now we have a membership and a podcast and online courses and all that great stuff. So that's a long story there.
So I did do a little research, or I think we all did as well. And you have workshops, you have courses that you offer, the membership. Tell me a little bit, like, what is the different things that you offer? Because, you know, when I hear a workshop and I hear a course, it's similar, but not exactly the same.
Yeah, I know. I think the special ed teacher in me, like, always wants to differentiate. So I'm like, ooh, I could provide this in a different way. So, you know, I started doing live conferences and workshops, like traveling. I started doing that probably 10 years ago. And I loved that. I loved like being in a room of all the people that get it, you know, that get how amazing it is, how hard it is. And I know, you know, as a former teacher, how rare it is to get training that is actually applicable to your class. Yes. You know, you've sat through a million meetings that you're like, this has nothing to do with me. So I loved doing that. I loved, you know, I would go and do an 8-hour session. But to me, the problem of that model is there's only so many places I can go. Like I had to limit, like I did 25 events a year. And then I just brain dumped on people. Like I was like, you give me 8 hours, like I will talk your ear off for 8 hours. Mm-hmm. And I know people can't take that all in. So we had this idea then for the professional development membership to basically take a lot of my workshops and cut them into small pieces and give them out like throughout the year. So the membership opens twice a year. It opens in September and it opens in January. We kind of want everyone to start together. Mm-hmm. And I give 4 to 6 small training videos each month. So basically, these are the things you should work on in October. That's it. Don't worry about anything else. These are the things you should work on in November. And it kind of creates this path and plan for your classroom. Mm-hmm. So that's where the member, and then we like built on, because we're like, well, we should give you this stuff too. So we have resources in there to put everything into action. And then after we started the membership, we wanted for our first summer for our members to do an in-depth course. So to take the summer and go really in-depth into something. And then we offer up that course for anyone that's not in the membership as well. So our first course was on behavior change. Our second course last summer was on literacy. And then in 2 weeks, we are opening our new course on executive functions. So anyone can purchase that, and then members get it as a part of their membership. So those are kind of the three things.
Okay, great. What would someone who's taking the newer course, the executive functioning course, what would they look forward to learning, or what are you hoping to accomplish with
that? Oh gosh, you put a penny in me here. I like love talking about executive functions. It like has kind of like taken over my brain in the last few years. Mm-hmm. And this course is really for anyone who is working with a child who is struggling to meet classroom or home expectations, whether that is a 4-year-old in a self-contained classroom or an 8th grader in gen ed. Really the missing piece are these executive functions. And in this course, we really dive into not only what they are, but how to identify which ones are missing in a functional and easy to use way, how to create a skill building plan, how to adapt the environment, and then how to monitor progress, take data, train your staff, make sure everything is implemented correctly. So it kind of walks through all the stages of that process. But each video is like 5 to 15 minutes, all on demand, so you can kind of watch it when you have the time.
Who would your target audience be? I know you speak a lot about special educators. Are you really trying to keep it more strictly to special ed, or are you looking at anyone else?
You know, it really depends on the topic. You know, last summer, our course was on literacy, and that was more focused on students with autism and special needs. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to behavior, and then when it comes to executive functions, you know, I talk to administrators a lot. They're like, who's this for? I'm like, this is for everyone. Whoever you want to show up at the Zoom, come on. Like, behavior is behavior. executive functions are something we all need, that we all have strengths and weaknesses with. So with things like that, anything that kind of falls under that umbrella, it's really any educator or clinician or parent, which sounds like ridiculous that it's so broad, but you know, we know like that's how the science works and that's how these skills work.
Okay, great. That's awesome.
What has inspired you to do this kind of stuff? What made you want to go into the special needs field, and how did, was there an inspiration specifically?
You know, when I was in high school, I did a lot of volunteering, which made me originally want to be a social worker, but I did a lot of volunteering at a Head Start preschool where they had a few kids with special needs that were fully included. And I always loved working with those kids. So that was like that initial, like someone, you know, there's always that like spark that someone has that they're like, ooh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then everything I did after that, I worked in special recreation for a long time. I always loved that. So that kind of originally got me in. And then once I was a teacher, I think I had like the perfect first year class, and not that it was perfect. It was extremely challenging, but man, I just like loved those kids. Like, and then you're just like, all right, I'm here, I'm stuck. Like you really have to love it.
You know, speaking of your first year, we did listen to your podcast about the five mistakes that you made, you know, your first year of teaching, and definitely, first of all, thanks for doing that, because it takes a really big person to admit all of the things, you know, done wrong. But one of the messages that we always try to put out there to everyone that we meet, parents, teachers, everybody that we work with is, yep, you're going to mess up. You're going to make mistakes, but you need to find 10 good things that you're going to do now from making that mistake. And, you know, listening to you talk about that first year, you had the first day was perfect. And then you had your second day, which was a lot less than perfect.
Yeah.
Like, well, there was the first one and the last one.
Yeah.
So I guess, you know, of course we can, you know, get into all of the mistakes you've made, but I guess really the question is, what was that like for you doing that podcast, kind of revisiting something that, you know, maybe wasn't exactly easy to talk about? And where did you find that humility?
You know, I've kind of always, in a weird way, liked talking about that, because that was what I wanted to hear in those days. Like if someone on my day two would have on Insta Stories didn't exist, but somewhere been like, you know what, I've been there too and it was horrible, but it gets better. I would have been like, oh, thank God. And so I've tried to have a good balance of like keeping things positive and productive, but also not shying away from like, this job is really, really hard. And I think if we don't talk about that, it's not going to really be helpful, because it's not acknowledging, you know, a huge like reality of the day to day. And so I've always from the start tried to talk about that. And it's, I think, sometimes tricky to talk about the hard parts of being an educator or clinician while still being respectful and talking about that client or student with dignity. So it's always like a fine line of how do we talk about that? I'm always very cognizant that like, yes, maybe you got the crap beat out of you, but the kid that beat the crap out of you is someone's baby. So like, we're not going to talk smack about him. It's like, how do we talk about that? It's okay that that day was really hard for you, but that day was also really hard for that kid. So it's kind of, I've always tried to have those two themes coexist. I don't know if I always do it well, but I always am very cognizant of being respectful of that child and that parent. Cause like, what if a parent of a kid like that is listening, that they're like, oh my God, this is what teachers are thinking of my kid. But it's also, I think, okay to acknowledge that some days we go home and eat French fries and drink beer for dinner because we hate our jobs that day, you know?
Yeah.
So balance.
For everyone to hear that, I wish when I was going into, I am a social worker, so I was looking for all those things.
Someone told you not to do that?
No. Everyone told me not to do that. They don't make money. Well, I just think anyone going into any field always wants to be able to like Google those things. What do I do about this? And so that kind of stuff, hearing the honesty from people in the field is so important. And so that's why I think I did really like that episode. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any inspiring stories that you can share? Could be about a student or someone that you're coaching along the way, you know, anything along those lines?
Yeah, I think, you know, I go back to a lot of things from the classroom, and a lot of, honestly, my resources or products or courses or things we talk about stem from those situations, which is always nice. Last time we did, and again, you're always trying to like talking about a former student in a way that is upholding confidentiality and all that. Last summer we did a bunch of podcast episodes that were like very casual, like candid, chatting about like different things that happened in the classroom. And a lot of those were as I was reminiscing on students or different things, I was like, oh, that's where that idea for that thing came from. But it was always to me really exciting to see. I had a very like, I would say high behavioral needs classroom typically every year that I was a teacher, without a lot of support. Like I was very rarely CPI certified or recertified, all that good stuff. And, you know, having that type of like high needs classroom, but also being able to work on academics at the same time and see that like the more we pushed academics, the behaviors go down. And it's always hard to hear when you're like in that season of teaching where it's like behaviors take over and you're like, that's BS. Like I can't push it. Academics aren't going to happen right now, but you really see once you start to push on skill building, the huge impact that can have. And then suddenly you have these kids that had this big, bad reputation that are like sweet as pie in reading. And they're like, you know, I've met teachers like high school teachers later that have a former student. And I'm like, oh God, when I got that kid, like I had to have two paras transferred into my room. And they were like, him? He wouldn't hurt a fly. And I'm like, well, now, but you should have met him when he was 12. Yeah. And a lot of that is because of focusing on skill building. And that's always kind of been my big message when it comes to behavior, because we so want to, you know, be in that reactive mode of like, well, this happened, what do I do? And it's, you know, behavior change happens like away from the negative behavior. And I think that's sometimes hard to see. That was a very roundabout answer to that question.
No, I can really relate. I was a teacher as well. And I was in a similar situation where I seemed to receive people in my classroom who did engage in a variety of challenging behaviors. Mm-hmm. And it was because they were the ones that I loved the most. And mm-hmm. I enjoyed working with individuals like that. And when you start in September and probably through October, and it's just, you know, out of control with some of the problem behaviors, the staff are getting trained and retrained as like from me and what to do. When you get that time, we're in New Jersey, so we have a teacher convention. So that's usually like right after teacher convention, come in and we start to actually get some work done. It's such a great feeling. And it's because you've done the work leading up to that.
Exactly.
You work, but it's not just let's work on behavior reduction for problem behaviors. It's absolutely what you're saying with that skill building. It's so key. And I feel like sometimes that's a piece that teachers definitely miss on either end, either focusing on the problem behaviors or focusing on the skill building without marrying them together.
Oh, for sure. And I think, you know, a lot of what has kind of always motivated me to like build the Autism Helper is that we don't learn this in undergrad. And the special ed degree is so broad. I mean, you could teach like self-contained preschool, or you could be a resource room teacher and teach pre-calculus in high school. Like, it's like boggles my mind that you're like certified for all of that. And I mean, in behavior, there's so much you don't know. In staff training, I mean, I've yet to see a college syllabus that or like program that covers anything with staff training at all.
That's and then Autism Helper.
Yeah, I know, right? and like, you know, then you're all of a sudden a teacher and they're like, oh, here's two staff members that you have to manage. Like, you're their boss. Like, you're their boss, but you have to tell them what to do every day. And it's like, oh, No one told me I had to do that or how to do that.
That is, that's a different skill set.
Yes, and
that is
absolutely.
Not something that a teacher, you know, knows that they need to do. I mean, you talked about it in the Mistake podcast about, you know, not giving the powers the training, but even more so, you are a manager. You have to manage the children, manage the behaviors, but you have to also manage your staff and the parents. You are like the boss of so much more than just those 20 little humans that you get to see every day. And that episode shined light on that when I started as a consultant. And, you know, I would give that kind of guidance to the teacher, you know, well, you know, you can share that, you can model this for your power performer, right? And they just didn't quite know how to do that. And with no fault of their own,
you know,
not ever been told that or taught that.
And I mean, the like whole industry of like management and leadership is a multi-billion dollar industry. Like CEOs get like specific coaching and training on how to lead and manage their teams. And then suddenly you're like plopped in there and they're like, oh, one of the most important part of your jobs you haven't even told you how to do. And you've received no training on it. Like, but good luck. Yes. Go ahead. And, you know, it's a lot, you know, and even as a clinician too, I mean, you have to collaborate with everyone on the IEP team and, you know, working with adults is many times people's least favorite part of their job. And it's, I think, because we don't have like the instruction behind it and the knowledge behind it of how to do it. It's really hard.
Absolutely. I completely agree. And it is something that some people come with naturally and others absolutely do not. So yeah. When you're placed in that position of being a teacher and your passion is teaching, and now you're made to be a manager, that can really be a turnoff to people.
Yeah, it is. And if you're like, I'm like by nature a people pleaser. So I think staff training was always hard for me because I was like, oh, I don't want them to not like me. Like, oh, that would be rude if I said that. And it's like, you have to kind of, you know, when I do like trainings and stuff, I sometimes go a little harsh on this because I think the reason that people sometimes avoid staff training is because they feel weird about it. They're like, mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm 26 and that paraprofessional is 42 and they've been in the field way longer than me. That's uncomfortable. And it's mm-hmm. My advice is like, get over it. Like, too mm-hmm. bad. Like, absolutely. You know, we ask our kids to do hard and uncomfortable things every day. And when it comes to like the safety of your classroom, you need to train your staff on your behavior plans. That's not a choice. Like, you, when safety's on the line, when academic engagement's on the line, like, you get over feeling awkward and you do it. And it's not going to be awkward forever. But it's, I think that's a big hesitation on it, is like, it feels weird. And I don't know.
And if you let that guide your behaviors, then a child is missing out.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in a huge way.
We talk about that all the time with parent training. Like, mm-hmm. The hard part is, I mean, I came into this field at, 21 years old, running parent groups. And I'm having, they're like, yeah. Where's the child behind you? You don't have,
yeah.
Like, no, I don't have any children, but I also have been doing a lot in this field to know how to maneuver and how to help you help your child. And yeah, no.
Yeah, that's a great point about parents too. It feels awkward with parents too, because you're like, oh, what if I'm not a parent, or what if I don't have a special needs child? How do I have the right? And it's like, you can do all of this in like, whether it's with colleagues or parents, in a respectful,
yeah.
You know, affirming way where you're still like acknowledging someone else's expertise. Like, I say that to teachers all the time. Like, if your parent has 20 more years experience than you, great. You use them as a resource, but you're still the leader. You know, you still have the degree and you still have that title and responsibility as the teacher, but you can do it in a way where you're learning from them and you're teaching them at the same time.
Yeah. No one's perfect. So sharing information in any aspect is always like, do it, even if it's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
On the flip side, when you are in that situation and maybe someone is not very respectful of you, or, you know, points out that they have shoes in their closet who are older than you, and you know,
direct quote maybe from someone.
It wasn't actually to me, it was to my supervisor. She would love that I still remembered that. It was from like 15 years ago and I never forgot it. But it's also, you know, pulling on, you know, being strong and being firm and just, you know, reminding yourself that you are for that student and whatever else that person that you're trying to help is going, they're going through something,
yeah.
And they're just kind of targeting you and sort of taking it out on you, and just sitting back, taking a deep breath and not taking it personal.
For sure. And I think, you know, with any type of collaboration, whether that be with parents or with staff, like, you have to almost follow kind of the same guidelines we do with our kids on like rapport building and, you know, kind of building that connection first. And I've seen a lot of BCBAs make big missteps, like swooping into a classroom, doing an observation, mm-hmm. And then they're like, okay, let me tell you the 27 things you're doing wrong. And that teacher's like, psh, ABA is BS. Goodbye. No, thank you. And I get it. I get it from that teacher's perspective big time. Like, they're like, I don't want your opinion. So you have to take the time to build rapport, acknowledge someone else's skill set and all that. Because if not, and all that training is going to go in one ear out the other.
Yeah. Just to switch gears a little bit, we were just going to, we were curious what topic you're kind of seeing as something in ABA that is needing more attention. Whether it's a problem topic or it just needs more.
How much time do we have? You know, I think a lot of the conversations right now in our field are really good on the direction I think that the field is moving towards and changing. And I think that, you know, in the last few years that there's been, I think, animosity between like the actually autistic community and the ABA community, if we're really going to go there, I think that a lot of great practitioners in our field have really been learning from that and listening. I know that I have, and that there's things that I used to do that I wouldn't do now. And I think that that's something that needs to continue to be talked about, that like, yeah, none of us are perfect. We should acknowledge our mistakes. And like we talked about earlier, you know, whether that's teaching mistakes or as a practitioner, but how can our field be more client focused and, acknowledge those individual differences of each person and really become a practice that like everyone wants to be part of. You know, Dr. Hanley, I quote all the time, but he always talks about that every session, every time you're with a child should be totally televisable. It should, everything should look great. Like not look great to just people that understand what's going on, look great to everyone. Like nothing should look, ooh, why are they refusing to do that or whatever? And I agree with that. And I think, you know, some of those like old school, like more extinction based practices of I'm going to hold out and win this battle, like they're not productive. And I thought about that a lot from like myself or even for my own kids, like no learning happens when you're at a level 10, you know, when you're like so escalated and like, let's get back to like being calm, being happy, and then we can have learning happen. But like trying to like hold out so you learn and you can whatever, it's like that's not a productive practice. And I think the more that, you know, we as a field can learn from things that have not happened, that have not gone well in the past, the better we're going to be moving forward. And I think the more collaborative we'll be moving forward with other, you know, practices. It's a long answer.
Well, what is one thing that you would want our listeners today to walk away from this podcast being able to use, do, or do that could be helpful or meaningful to them?
I mean, maybe we'll just stick with this theme of like learning from your mistakes. Like I'll just like embed this into all the answers. I think that it's okay to acknowledge things that, you know, you did that didn't go well and not to be hard on yourself. Like in our executive functions course, we talk a lot about like having a growth mindset and teaching the growth mindset, especially when it comes to metacognition skills. And I think we as like educators and parents and clinicians need to have that too, that like, hey, that how I used to do that didn't work, or how I did that 2 days ago did not go well. So what am I going to do differently? I think if that's like a takeaway anyone can have in any field or position, that is always a good one.
Yeah, definitely. And are there any specific words of encouragement you would give to teachers, special education teachers out there in the field, going into the field, kind of being thrown into that spot that we talked about you being in?
Yeah, I think right now the job of an educator is like 5,000 times harder than it was probably 2 years ago. This has been a year. And if this is your first year or 20th year as a teacher or a member, you know, working in schools, it is not always going to be this bad. Like I have to, I don't know why I feel like I can say that, like I can see the future, but I just feel like it has to get better. And oh my God, that is maybe not that encouraging, but it, you know, it's been rough. I think teachers have barely been through it, and teachers have been so resilient. Like they have had to redo the entire way they did their job basically overnight and then redo it again and again and again. And I feel like our society has not really like acknowledged or thanked teachers. People have just like kind of, you know, been like, oh, well, my kids are home again. Great. Like, so it's been a lot for teachers right now. So I think knowing that, you know, it's got to get better, right?
We spoke with a teacher who said that during that first year of COVID, not to bring that up, but she had live classes for like most of the day, and then every night had to record lessons, you know, for the students.
It's wild.
So like, you're talking like 15-hour days.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And learning to use technology that you've never used before, and like, I mean, and teachers just went so above and beyond, like dropping things off at kids' houses and yeah, recording things and having one-on-one sessions and setting up green screens in their house. And like, it's like really amazed me how great teachers have done in such a hard situation. And I think people were looking for this year for a little reprieve and did not get it, but I, for some reason, just feel it coming next year for you.
Well, that's the optimism of I think that you just exude. And it's funny because when I look at society, and especially honestly around education or healthcare, it's often very negative right now. All the things that didn't go well, or we couldn't do. But then what about focusing on the positives? Because the way you reshape, reframe the way you look at the world really does make a difference on who you are and all those that are around you.
Yes, I know. We've done a few podcast episodes on like good things that came out of distance learning and like e-learning. And yeah, it was horrible for a lot of us. But like, I mean, it was horrible for me. Like I look back at that time period, I was like super pregnant. I had two toddlers at home and I was like, ooh, like you couldn't pay me to do that again. But also like, I spent so much time with my kids and like we did like workbooks every day and all this. Like there were good things that came out of it. And it, you know, the hard things happened and are going to happen. And you're right. Exactly. Like how we frame things in ourselves, but also to our teams, to our kids is going to make such a big difference.
Right. Because we're not going to change the fact that certain events are happening. They are happening. It's how we approach them that really can make
yes.
the difference.
Yes. 1,000%.
Sasha, you've done so many things with the Autism Helper, and I think I counted almost 800 videos that you have on that website. My goodness.
I hope you individually counted them like that.
Yeah, but I did have to scroll through my page. It was 5 minutes. I won't get back, but that's okay. But what, you know, and you talked about doing a lot of workshops and you're here with us speaking and you speak very, very well. You're very articulate. It's like having a conversation with a friend and colleague, honestly, and we just met you. So what do you have to say to, newer clinicians who have to conduct workshops and, have to speak in front of large groups? And, you know, how do you not use the word, anytime? Because you do not ever use the word, and I want to know your secret.
You know what? Now I'm going to say, now I'm very aware of it.
To our last person that we talked about it so much. And then the minute we said it, he said it.
This was a process. So I got asked to do my first like out of town live session probably close to 10 years ago. And I was terrified and I was counting down the hours. I was like 48 hours from now, it'll be done. 36 hours from now, it'll be done. I just kept being like, it'll be finished. And it was really at first a total like fake it till you make it. Like someone's like, can you come to a session? I'm like, oh yeah, I totally do that. And I'm like, no, I don't. Oh my God. And you know what? It got easier. Like things get better. Everything does. Like thinking about distance learning and all that, like all those things were horrible at first. It got better. We got used to it. And my husband jokes because I used to make him like before I'd get on a plane, I'd be like, give me a pep talk. And after a while, he's like, you don't need the pep talk. And I was like, I know, I just like hearing it. And then like, you know, tell me I'm great. You know, tell me I'm going to do good. And then after a while, I was like, God, I haven't got a pep talk in like years. I could use one of those. So it does, you get more comfortable, you get more confident. A lot of like, I think when you hone in on like why you're scared to give a training or if you have to like train your staff or parents, like if you're like, what am I exactly nervous about? Well, I'm nervous that I'm going to run out of content 2 hours into a 4-hour session. I'm nervous I'm going to not be able to answer questions. I think once you figure out like, oh no, now I know how to pace my content. Now I know if someone asks me a question and I can just say, I don't know. And no one cares. Like people are like, great. Like I, for sure, when I'm in an audience, respect when someone's like, I don't know, I'll have to look into that and get back to you. I'm like, yes, don't lie to me. So I think once you focus on why that's scary, besides just the general idea that public speaking is scary, then you can overcome some of those things. Like, I'm not going to run out of content. I am going to be able to answer the questions. You know, people are going to want to hear what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So you acknowledge that you're feeling a certain way and then find the solution. Are you sure you didn't go to school for social work?
I know. Maybe I should have. But yeah, I think. And then I got my stupid master's anyways. So I went to the same amount of school.
My dad said the same thing to me when I told him I wanted to study psychology. He said, well, you know, you're going to have to get your master's. And I was like, all right. That's oh, well.
I can't. All right. Now, so we do this fun thing. We have some rapid fire questions for you. They're just fun, silly questions that you can answer as fast as you can. All right. Ready? A four-letter word that starts with S.
Oh my God. Now I can only think of the four. Safe.
Safe. Favorite store.
Trader Joe's.
Tool you never leave home without.
Cell phone? That's not a tool.
That's what I said.
Yeah, cell phone.
Yeah. That's good. I mean, it does multiple things. There's a calculator in there. That's
true. That's true. Too. Yeah.
Stay in or go out?
Stay in.
Your go-to lazy dinner?
Sushi. Takeout sushi. Not making it. Takeout sushi.
Your favorite pizza topping?
Pepperoni.
Very good. Favorite Disney character?
Oh, this is so hard. Belle from Beauty and the Beast.
Favorite rainy day activity?
Watching movies, watching Bravo, watching anything.
Your life motto?
This is so hard. I don't know.
She said,
Don't say, That's my life motto. There you go.
That was either like really easy or really hard for people. They're like,
you guys, maybe I did that on purpose. That was like part of my shtick. You don't know. I
planted that in there. That's so funny. It was so great getting to talk to you. This was like my favorite.
Awesome.
Thank you so much for having me. This was really fun.
So is there anything that you wished we would have asked you?
No, I mean, you asked me my favorite Disney princess or Disney character. What more can I hope for? At the Autism Helper, we provide resources and strategies for teachers, clinicians, and parents. We have curriculum and downloadable activities, plus courses and trainings and free resources. Our new course on executive functions is coming out at the start of May. I don't know when this is airing. So if you're interested in that, that will be open for 1 week in the start of May.
Awesome. Well, you guys go check out the Autism Helper, and thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening. Looking for more? Be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast app and Instagram at The Interactive Journey.
Questions, comments, or want to be a guest on our show? We'd love to hear from you. You can message us at podcast@interactivekids.com or on Instagram at The Interactive Journey.